So three prostrations. Prostrations are a powerful practice to, I reiterate this every week because I know people think this is empty, and I mean worthless or something. A lot of people do anyway. Lama Yeshe, who's my teacher, one of my, you know, Lama Yeshe Lama Zopa, he used to say, people said, we should get rid of prostrations. That's not very Western. And he said, you know, if nothing else, I think it's not a bad idea just to put your head on the ground once in a while. But on the other hand, it's considered to be a powerful practice for purifying, particularly if you use your mind and your body and your speech all at the same time, which you can do. There's a little mantra, Om Namo Manjushriye. Some of you know it. So we'll do that. And then we start up, hands go here, and then you can imagine white light coming in here, purifying your body and your speech, blue light, red light for your speech from the Buddhas in front of you, and then blue light your heart, and you touch your head to the ground. And but it's a great antidote. The reason I didn't want to do this when I first got introduced to Buddhism was because I thought it was bowing down to graven images or whatever. And really we're paying homage to the enlightened beings, but also our own potential to become a Buddha, to realize the Dharma, and to become the Sangha. So we really, this is a powerful transformative method for our mind. And on top of all of that, what's the biggest obstacle to learning? Arrogance. If you think you know it all, you're not going to learn anything. So this is an antidote to arrogance. So, because us, we, you know, our ego doesn't want to bow down to anything, you know, normally. I'm not speaking about you people, but I'm talking about me. So anyway, here we go. So, Om Namo Manjushriye, Namo Sushriye, Namo Uttamashriye, Soha. Om Namo Manjushriye, Namo Sushriye, Namo Uttamashriye, Soha. Om Namo Manjushriye, Namo Sushriye, Namo Uttamashriye, Soha. See, you guys could have done that too. It have been a good exercise. Open up the channels and the chakras and whatever, you know, psychic channels. So I walked in the door and I asked Donna, I gave her two pieces of paper, and I said, would you mind copying back and front for everybody who's going to be here? And I said, I'm not trying to teach your patience, but it does work out that way. Oh my goodness.
Dummy. Big toe.
Quick. See, again, more. Donna, you're so fortunate to have...
You haven't had enough drama?
No. So, hey, I didn't see that coming. See, you need difficult people in your life to teach you patience. You can't learn it from your friends. So you should rejoice if you have a good enemy or two. Don't go out looking for them, though. They'll show up. Thank you so much. Yeah, that's good. Oh, my goodness. All right. And the center manager has to get her 2 cents. She has to do the final touches, realizing that this cork might buckle. All right, well, see, the Dharma teaching has already started.
Good job, Don.
Thank you. That's really, we're done. That was the main point of today.
Water.
Yeah.
Just water.
Just water.
Thank you very much. That one's quite. I'll put these back in the kitchen.
Okay. Yeah, it's all karma. All right. This thing's been around 28 years. All right. I just found this book on cultivating compassion an hour before I came today, and I had read it. I've read it before, but that'll be the topic, the main topic of today, I hope. We'll get around to it. All right, so let's. Where's our Aum say? I ran her off. The prayers. Donna. You going to take over, Jill? All right. So we start out by doing aspirational prayers. You know, these are to set our motivation, but they're not, you know, you have to really think about the meaning of the words to set our motivation. Now I'll just go whoosh, knock that over.
Very good.
We trust me to do it. Thank you, Donna. All right, so Donna's our Omsay means the Chet leader. How many people are brand new here today? First time? Okay, a couple, three, four, five. Anyway, so you can think of these as we're planting some seeds now to make the rest of the morning beneficial to our minds. So that's what these prayers are about.
Okay, so we'll start at the top of page 34 in the gold prayer book, and it's on the first printed sheet if you've got the yellow, the white notebook like Don has. And we'll say Shakyamuni Buddha's mantra, which in the gold book is above the words daily prayers. Taya ta om mane mane maha manaye soa. Taya ta om mane mane maha manaye soa. And then we'll go down to the middle of the page and recite the four immeasurables in English. And then we'll flip over and recite and chant them in Tibetan. And while we've got them in English, let's go a little bit slowly and think about the meaning of these words. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. And then the chanting Tibetan is at the bottom of page 37. Sam chen tam che de wa dong de wei yu dong den pa gyu chi. Yeah. Dhammi. Drill are your cheek. Nearing Jodham. Nidham drill chant Chenrezig's mantra 8 times and Green Tara's mantra 7 times. Om Mani Padme Hum. 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 Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu E Soha. 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 Om Tare Tu Tare Tu E Soha.
Okay, the children can go to their classes now.
Whoa. Okay. 44. So, good morning. I guess everybody's at the beach or sleeping in. Anyway, and Geshe-la's gone, so the person who keeps the vows is gone. That makes a difference, too. So last week we talked about, there were several, a lot of things we talked about, but I think the biggest one was a distinction between empathy, which I have to admit I used to define as compassion, and compassion, empathy, you know, sort of like feeling with someone suffering, and turns out may not necessarily be our best friend, you know, may end up causing us more problems. You know, empathy burnout and a lot of issues come up, you know, when we're driven by empathy. But compassion is as distinct from empathy is the wish, and it's based on loving kindness, isn't it? Because if you hate somebody and they're suffering, what happens? Do you feel compassion? Now, I know some people here don't like Donald Trump. Probably most people here. You know, if you heard he'd been shot yesterday, you know, some people would rejoice, right? Or he was sick, or when Saddam Hussein got killed or whatever, you know, you might have gone, yeah, not good. In other words, for compassion to arise, in our mind, we have to feel connected. Like when someone we love experiences suffering, we wish either we go into the empathy mode, you know, where we feel so badly about their suffering that we actually suffer too, or we go into the compassion mode where we wish them to be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. And again, studies have been done that show that compassion doesn't make the mind unhappy. It buoys the mind up. It's a positive mental state. Whereas empathy, on the other hand, causes a negativity to arise in the mind. And the mind's not, typically not happy and not operating at full capacity. We'll say it that way. This is, based on some pretty good science that's been done with meditators. Actually, with people who were right off the street, they trained one group in empathy, one group in compassion, and showed a distinction. And then they took the people trained in empathy and trained them in compassion, and their mind became more positive. So we're more interested in compassion. And the two arms of the two wings of the bird of enlightenment that we talk about here, you need compassion. That's one wing, and we need wisdom, and we need them together. So sometimes we think of, we put our hands together like this, we think usually left hand wisdom, right hand method, the principal method being compassion. So the union of method and wisdom like that at the heart. So, one of the, in Lama Zopa, we're going to do this meditation we did last week. We'll decide I'll figure it out as we go what other practices might be helpful, but this is always helpful to generate the mind of bodhicitta. Lama Zopa Rinpoche, not this year, but last year, I have in my notes, he said that everything you do at the center that has to do with really everything, but particularly when you come in for spiritual practice, for Sunday morning and so forth, we need to take a moment to cultivate bodhicitta, or this bodhi, awakening, citta, mind. So some call it awakening mind, mind of enlightenment. And Jeffrey Hopkins, our friend here, translates it as the altruistic intention to become enlightened based on love and compassion. So, what does that mean? It means I wanna help others. The person that can truly help others is somebody who's got their act together, right? A Buddha would be the quintessential helper. The person who's eliminated all their faults, developed all their qualities. So we want to help others. The person who can best help others is an enlightened being. And the best way to do that is to cultivate bodhicitta. And the best way, and we have to do that on the basis of love and compassion. So, and not just sentimental love, but it's for all beings. It's including our enemies, the strangers, and the friends. It's universal living beings. That's the motivation for full enlightenment, to achieve full enlightenment. So we can't exclude even, like I said, Donald Trump, if he's your nemesis. We've got to get enlightened for him too. So we'll start out, we'll do a couple of minutes of just mindfulness of the breath meditation, and then we'll, this could go on for a while, sometimes 15, 20 minutes, if you need to stretch your legs at some point, and try to get in a position where you can sit still. If you're in a chair, the ideal position is probably slightly forward, not leaning back in the chair. Arms. I want... So, you know, you want your shoulders kind of back and down. Hands in your lap and your thumbs touching, forming a little sort of oval or triangle with the thumbs touching at the level of the navel. Arms a little bit away from the side to allow some ventilation, right? Then the eyes can be closed or slightly open to let some light in. The tongue's resting at the roof of the mouth. The chin slightly tucked in. And if you've got your legs crossed, you know, half lotus, full lotus, whatever's comfortable, as long as your spine is straight. This posture automatically calms the mind down if you can do it comfortably. If you're sitting in a chair, you want feet flat on the floor. And take a couple of exaggerated breaths. Do it like three deep exaggerated breaths, and then slow your breathing down and bring your full awareness to the process of breathing, whether it be the rising and falling of the abdomen, the expansion of the chest, or the sensation of the breath at the nostrils. So we'll start out with these three exaggerated breaths. You're following the breath. You want to stay with the breath through the entire cycle of inhalation and then that slight pause between inhalation and exhalation, then throughout the entire exhalation, and then again that slight pause before you begin inhalation. So you want to like if you were looking at something through a microscope and then you went from low power to high power, you want to go to oil immersion. You want to bring your mind like to the level of oil immersion where you're really focusing on very carefully, very precisely on the process of breathing. And when your mind wanders, gently but firmly bring it back to your experience of breathing. And so to just say, develop the awakening mind, or generate bodhicitta, or do this practice for the benefit of all beings, doesn't really, for most of us, it doesn't really, we don't feel anything, there's no experience of, it's just words. And so it takes, in the beginning, we call it, you know, effortful development or generation of bodhicitta. It's not effortless because dedicating our spiritual life, actually our whole life, to the benefit of all beings is antithetical to our egocentric, self-centered way of thinking. And so obviously the ego is going to put up a bit of a battle. It's going to resist this kind of meditation. We just have to push through it. We just need to do it every day and think about what it means as much as possible, all every moment of every day, to make this life worthwhile. Otherwise, we're really not all that different than animals. Just looking after number one. So the first step in cultivating bodhicitta, or awakening mind, which is a distinguishing feature of the Tibetan Mahayana Buddhism that we practice here. The first step is called developing equanimity. And this meditation could go on for weeks, but obviously we're going to do it in 5 minutes or less here. But you imagine someone that you, when you see them in your mind's eye, is someone you feel attraction toward. Like you want, it could be family member, best friend, whomever. And you want to notice that experience of attachment to the friend. Usually we label them friend because they've been kind to us. Or they're family and they have been kind to us, because not all family members are our friends. Then in the middle, we imagine the friend to the left. In the middle is this stranger, that faceless person in the elevator or driving in front of us, or in line in front of us at the grocery store, or whatever. Vast majority of beings are in this category, including animals and beings in all the different realms of samsara. So those are the strangers that we feel indifference toward. And then the so-called enemy, which sounds pretty strong, you might go, well, I don't have any enemies, but we definitely have people that we feel some resistance to or aversion toward. These, we imagine this person, you can just imagine one person or a group of people, but imagine this person to your right, sitting in front of you, kind of like a hologram, all three classifications of beings: friend, stranger, and enemy. And get a sense of the feeling of attachment to the friend, indifference toward the stranger, and aversion toward the enemy. And the goal or the intention of this meditation is to get enlightened for all sentient beings, which includes the vast number of beings that we feel indifference toward and the so-called enemies. They're all part of the mix. So we need to develop an equanimous attitude toward all three categories of beings. And so different methods of doing this. One is to realize that these are just mere labels that are changeable. Friends can become enemies, enemies can become friends, enemies, beings that we feel indifference toward, that we don't know, can become friends or enemies. These labels are not fixed. And in past lives, people, some of us are used to this meditation, but it's kind of mind-blowing when we think that the mind has no beginning, which makes sense. Like a number line is what was before that. Well, there was a moment of mind before that, and a moment of mind before that, and a moment of mind. It makes no sense that there would ever be a beginning of time or of the mind. Had to be something there before that, and so we talk about beginningless mind, and in each lifetime we've had a mother, and so we focus on the fact that all beings have been family. We're all connected, although we don't remember it. All beings have been our mother, our father, and so on. So we are all interconnected in that way. And then to focus on the being that the hardest one to work with, actually two, are the friend. And so it's important to try to loosen the attachment that we have to the friend. But understanding that because we see them as existing from their own side, we tend to exaggerate their positive qualities and underestimate their negative qualities, and that's what leads to attachment. And again, this is a changeable relationship. Many times, look at the divorce rate. Goodness, people that used to be your best friend, now you can't even stand to be in the same room with them. What is that about? Not a reliable label to put on anyone. And usually our friends don't tell us our faults. They mostly focus on our good qualities and tell us about them, hopefully, once in a while. They don't tell us our faults in areas where we need to improve. We have to look over to the so-called enemy to get that information. So the friend is actually the friend of our worst enemy, our ego, our self-centered mind. So is the friend of our worst enemy really our friend? Something, to consider. And then the so-called enemy is only an enemy because of something they said or did. Sometimes it's just because of how the way they look. You see somebody and you go, you feel aversion toward them instinctively. And this is from some past karma you have with this being. But this, generally speaking, the people that we have aversion toward have said something or done something that we don't like, that embarrassed us, hurt our feelings, made us look bad, ripped us off, you know, have, you know, one of the, whoever, you know, people that do stuff, then we go, how dare they treat me this way or say that to me like that. Could be a coworker, even somebody in your family. And again, realizing that these labels are transitory, ephemeral. They're just labels. They're not fixed. If they were, that person would always, the enemies would always and forever be an enemy. And they can become a friend with just a few kind words. You can change that relationship sometimes from enemy or person you feel aversion toward to friend. And that person harmed us, at least our perception of being harmed, for a reason. We know from the laws of causality that nothing happens, not even spilt water, happens without a reason. So past actions ripened, our own past actions have ripened in the form of being harmed by this being. And so, as Shantideva says, in one famous Buddhist text, he says, if somebody hits you with a stick, you don't get mad at the stick. You get angry at the person wielding the stick. Well, in this situation, the so-called enemy is like a stick. The real source of the harm that we're experiencing is our own selfish, self-cherishing mind that planted the karmic seed in the past. And now that's ripening, and this person's just delivering the message, delivering the goods, which is suffering, causing us saying, doing things to cause us to suffer. And furthermore, it's impossible to be happy without being patient, without having a mind that's patient and tolerant. Who teaches us that? Not our friends. We need difficult people in our lives. You know, the statue on the altar, the new one that we got of Lama Atisha, there's stories about his cook. He had this cook who was rude to him and everybody that came to visit. And people ask him, at least the story I remember, people ask him, why do you keep that jerk around? And Atisha said, how else am I going to learn patience? I need this guy. He's my ticket out of samsara. So we need to loosen the grip of aversion that we have toward the so-called enemy, loosen the grip of attachment to the so-called friend, and then realizing that this vast number of beings that are strangers that we feel indifference towards can, again, this is not a fixed label. So we have equal regard for the three kinds of beings. Equanimity. Friends, strangers, and so-called enemies. We try to develop a level-mindedness toward these beings. And this is the foundation of developing bodhicitta. Without this, impossible. Impossible, really, to develop what's called universal compassion, which is compassion for all living beings. So this is sort of, in more ways than one, a foundational meditation, contemplation. Now we can begin to think about how all beings are equal. Not equal in every way, but equal in wanting happiness and not wanting to suffer. We all equally want happiness and don't want to suffer. From the smallest, tiniest insect to, or even microscopic beings, you know, little animals. They, you know, they move away from any kind of stimulus that would harm them. You know, up to the largest animals. Nobody wants suffering, and nobody, and everybody wants happiness. So as I said last week, the Dalai Lama, when he does this meditation, he imagines this sort of line, and he's on one side, and universal living beings on the other side, and he goes, what do I want? I want happiness. I don't want to suffer. And then universal living beings, excuse me, universal living beings, they say the same thing. I want happiness. I don't want to suffer. I'm one. Universal living beings are countless. So whose happiness is more important, the happiness of one or the happiness of countless others? It's something to think about. At least their happiness is as important as ours. So we're all equal and equally wanting happiness and to avoid suffering. And the next contemplation has to do with the faults of the self-cherishing, selfish, egocentric sense of I or me. We call it self-cherishing, but it's self-cherishing selfishness. Normally, we think that selfishness is protecting us. It's like our friend. Like if I don't look after myself, who is? But on closer examination, we look at all the negative karma. In fact, we say that all the suffering, if the cause of suffering is negative karma, that is actions done by, motivated by greed, hatred, and ignorance, if all the suffering is the result of negative karma, then all the suffering from the beginning of beginningless time, so forever and ever, between individuals, political parties, countries, you name it. All the suffering is the result of one demon. And it's not out there. It's not somebody out there. It's our own selfish, self-cherishing attitude that dwells in the center of our heart. That's the real devil, if you want to pick on somebody. It's our own selfishness. Not that we're bad, it's just, and it's not who we are, but it's who we think we are. It's a projection of ignorance. You know, we do exist, clearly we do, but we project a false sense of I and we cling to it as most precious. It's called self-grasping ignorance. And then anybody that offends me, says something that's not nice to me, gets labeled enemy. And people that are nice to me get labeled friends. And I'm always looking to take care of me particularly taking care of my, you know, feeding my senses, you know, my at least the five senses that we're aware of, and even the mental consciousness, we usually don't pay much attention to that sense, the so-called sixth sense. But mainly we spend our time trying to take care of our tactile, gustatory, olfactory, auditory, and whatever the other one is, visual senses. We're always looking for things that are attractive, that are nice. So our ego is in constant pursuit of things that can never give us lasting peace and happiness, and in the end cause suffering for us and others. Killing, stealing, the actions of body and speech are obvious. With, you know, self-cherishing attitude, the cause of all killing, stealing, adultery, lying, slander, harsh and frivolous talk. And then the mental states, greed, hatred, and close-minded ignorance, all, you know, just the seed of self-cherishing is there as the cause of all of these major sources of our suffering. We have to be honest about it. It's not protecting us. We need to take it on, recognize it when it arises, and not give in to it. So we have to recognize the faults of self-cherishing. And then we turn our mind toward the thought of cherishing others. For happiness, Lama Zopa says, for happiness, cherish others. Like a little bumper sticker we used to sell here. Don't know if we do or not now, but for happiness, cherish others. So if we cherish others, we wouldn't kill them. We wouldn't steal from them. We wouldn't cheat on them. We wouldn't lie. We wouldn't badmouth them. We wouldn't speak harshly or waste their time with frivolous gossip and so on. So cherishing others is the key out of this mess called cyclic existence. Totally antithetical to our egocentric worldview. And it's not enough to say, I cherish others. We need to do something about it. It's our job to go do something about helping others. And the next contemplation is exchanging the attitude of self-cherishing with the attitude of cherishing others. So, and it calls it exchanging self with others, but it's actually exchanging the attitude of self-cherishing, which dominates our lives, with cherishing others. So, you know, you can think like this, that you know, you get up this morning and eat breakfast so you can stay healthy, so you can benefit others. Because you cherish them. When you go to work, you clean up. You try to look your best for others. You go do your job to the best of your ability for others. You exercise and take care of your health so you can better serve others and live a longer, healthier life. In other words, you change your instinct from self-cherishing to others. The energy, which was sucky, you know, this very tight, closed-minded, stifling energy of self-cherishing, is redirected toward others. Alright? Now, the next one is a meditation on, it's called Tonglen. We could spend a long time on this, but we'll just spend a few minutes working with. First of all, you want to work with yourself. So you can imagine in front of you, you, and particularly at a time when you might have been struggling. It could be now, it could have been when you were a child, when you had some difficulties, or a teenager, or whenever that was. But you imagine you at that particular age and the conversations that you made up about yourself and the sadness and the suffering that you experienced as a result of that. And you imagine that that negativity, that suffering, kind of rises, comes off your body in the form of a black orb, and you begin to inhale, and you don't have to do it with one inhalation, but it comes in through your left nostril, so you just breathe slowly, and you can see that black orb of your suffering coming closer and closer, and eventually it goes, you breathe it in your left nostril, it goes down to your heart, and it destroys, like an atomic bomb, it destroys this rock of self-cherishing that has encased your heart, of hearts, which is made of light, really brilliant light. So breathing in the suffering, taking on your own suffering, you know, and you can be thinking, may I be free of suffering and the causes of suffering? That's compassion. So we breathe in that suffering, comes into our nostril, goes down to our heart, destroys our self-cherishing mind. Then our body is full of light. And then we breathe that light out through the right nostril, and it goes back to the you in front. Maybe you were a little boy or a little girl, and you'd made up all kinds of stories about yourself and how you weren't good enough, and you weren't, you know, blah blah blah. And you give that child or that young person this light, which is, may you be happy and have the causes of happiness, which is love. And, you know, you can even have a conversation, you know. You see, what you said about yourself, it wasn't true. It just made up. You deserve to be loved and have the causes of love. So you can do this couple of times with yourself. You always start with yourself in the Tonglen, taking on your suffering, destroying self-cherishing at your heart, and then giving back this white light of loving kindness. So we're practicing, we're cultivating compassion by taking on the suffering, and we're cultivating loving kindness by giving happiness and its causes. So do that for just a minute. Now you can work with you can gradually expand this. You can work with a friend or even a group of people, like people that are you know, like all the people in the world with AIDS, or all the people in the world with Alzheimer's, or you can work with one individual that's a friend. pick that person and again breathe in their suffering and give them, you know, take away the suffering and the causes of their suffering and give them happiness and the causes of happiness. And then maybe we'll pick somebody that you really dislike. I suggest those of you who have, yeah, people, those of us that have issues with our president, he'd be a good one to work with. Because he is just like we are, wants to be happy, doesn't want to suffer. But whoever you pick, imagine that they're suffering. Rises above, you breathe it into your heart, destroying your self-cherishing and wishing them happiness and the causes of happiness. And now the next step in developing bodhicitta is sometimes called the supreme wish, the attitude of universal responsibility, and it sort of breaks down into it's an attitude. Obviously, it's not something that necessarily we can do. But it's something we aspire to do. And it's called, the supreme wish is, I take personal responsibility for the happiness of all my kind mother sentient beings, of all living beings. I take personal responsibility for leading all beings from their current state of suffering, misery, wherever they are, in whatever realm of existence they're in, to guide them from wherever they are to supreme enlightenment by myself alone. It's my job. I take personal responsibility for the happiness of all living beings. To guide them to supreme enlightenment. and I can never give up. Never, ever give up. And then bodhicitta, the final step in this meditation is realizing that we don't have the capability now, not even for ourselves to achieve. We can't even take care of ourselves, basically. We have so many issues. But we set our aim at, you know, I must help others. The method to do that is supreme enlightenment. Therefore, I must eliminate my faults and develop my good qualities. I must practice renunciation, bodhicitta, emptiness, the two stages of generation and completion stage of Tantra. I must practice the entire path to enlightenment. I mean, and here in this really, really short life, I don't care how old you are, it will go so fast. And you have met the teachings, and we have, you know, qualified teacher here, Geshe Gyalak. We meet people like this, Lama Zopa Rinpoche and Khyentse Rinpoche, and then next April, the Dalai Lama will be here, if all goes well. I mean, what an amazing life opportunity we have to practice the path that where all of our dreams for ourselves and others can come true. Are we gonna squander this opportunity? Or are we gonna actually do it? Take the steps. Do the work. So I must become enlightened for all living beings based on love and compassion. And enlightenment is just another way of saying that we've fully developed our qualities and eliminated all of our faults and shortcomings. And it is possible. Because you do have a mind, and it changes from moment to moment. It is possible for you to do this. It is possible for each of us to do this. Any questions about the meditation or what we did talk about last week? Empathy, compassion. Yeah. This is Andre, by the way. He always sits there. That's his seat.
I like being in front. I'll go see you back there. If I heard you right about empathy, right,
mm-hmm.
You're saying that it's not close enough? All right. Empathy is, I never heard empathy like that. What I understand about empathy is that it's being able to see and feel another person's pain or discomfort, been able to relate to that. And I've always felt like that actually before you can truly have compassion, you have to have empathy. Empathy helps us to be able to see through the eyes of equanimity, I felt. And then we could begin to have compassion for others. So, for example, the guy that murdered my son, I can have empathy for him because I recognize, right, his pain and his suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can see that we are similar,
right,
in that, and that we want to be free from that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can have compassion for him because I truly, I don't want him to suffer, no matter mm-hmm. what he's done.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want him to suffer. But I always felt like empathy and compassion,
mm-hmm.
equanimity, all of these work together. But the way that you explained it, it was kind of like empathy is the thing that's disturbing our mind. And I don't really understand that.
Were you here last week?
No, I was not.
Well, then go back and look at the last week. No, I had articles all over the place from Scientific American and an article from the New York, from the Wall Street Journal on, in fact, I've got it on my cell phone. Anyway, I'll share it with you. But, you know, I'll give you an example. Richard Davidson and some Matthew Ricard and some people at the University of Wisconsin did a study on this. So I'm not making this up. But I'll back up and say that years ago we had this great Lama called Geshe Donyo, D-O-N-Y-O, and Venerable Sinla translated before him. He lived at Rodney's house the whole summer and taught here. And anyway, everybody loved Geshe Donyo. And he was, you could ask him anything, and he had laser answers for everything, just cut right to the chase. And I asked him, I said, Geshe, it seems like to me compassion kind of has a quality of sadness to it. You know, it makes you sad when you feel other people suffering, when you see them suffering, you can feel what it would be. You know, you imagine, you know, you see it all the time, right? You imagine what it would be like to suffer like that, and it makes you sad. And I said, so it seems like compassion would make you sad. And he said, that ain't compassion. He said, compassion only makes you happier and happier. So then, going back, Richard Davidson and these, they did PET scans. And anyway, they took a group of people, and these weren't experienced meditators, but they taught them basically Tonglen, you know, may you be happy and may you be free of suffering and its causes and have happiness in its cause, the loving kindness meditation. They taught one group that meditation, and they taught another group some practices to develop empathy. Then they studied they asked them what their experience was, and the people who had been trained in empathy had more distress, more of an unhappy mind. The people that had been trained in compassion had a positive experience, even though they were seeing people suffering, you know, when they were, but their reaction to it was, may you be free of the suffering and have happiness. Okay, versus the empathic people who were identifying with it and then feeling some kind of turned out to be negative emotional state. And then they went on to say, this is probably why in the medical profession we can have this conversation. And but that's my job, and it's probably why in the medical profession the burnout rate is like 60%. Because, you know, they call it, you know, empathy fatigue. One of the terms they use. So then they took the people that they'd been trained in empathy, and they went and trained them in these same meditations. on compassion, and they were able to generate again the same positive emotional response. So this is not just me saying this. And I promise you, I used to define compassion as empathy. Jeffrey Hopkins, in this book, he defines it as mercy, compassion being like mercy. So it's a question that needs to be looked at. I have the same experience that you do. It's like, unless I can empathize, in other words, if I see somebody who's really depressed, do I need to go to the point of going, oh, I know how it feels to be depressed and feel sad, and then go, may you be free of suffering? Do I need to go to that step, or can I go straight to compassion? That's a question worth asking. And for some of us, it might be we have to do it, you know, that way. For others, maybe we can just go straight to compassion. But it seems like this guy's written a book. I've got it. Anyway, somebody's written a book talking about it's not positive what they say about empathy. But it gives compassion as an alternative. If the alternative to empathy is apathy, then let's stick with empathy, right? But if the alternative to empathy is compassion, let's go with that, because that's positive, and that also generates action. It's an active. For example, I was looking at somebody's Facebook account last night who used to be a Buddhist nun, and a good friend of mine. I've known her for years and years, and she was talking about, on her Facebook account, because she's from the Bay Area, she was somebody, there was a gay activist basically saying, you know, I really love all my Buddhist friends, and I think y'all are so great, and I like your attitude, but you don't do anything. You know, you just sit around and think things, but you don't take action. It's not true. But that was that person's perspective. And it is true for some of us, because we're not ready. You know, in Buddhism, wisdom and compassion have to be conjoined, right? We gave the example last week of the three monkeys that ran up to the river to save the three fish from drowning. Idiot compassion. Well, several people who commented on this post said, yep, a lot of us Buddhists practice idiot compassion. You know, we see the suffering, but we don't have the wisdom combined with the compassion to know what's the right thing to do and then take the action. So always wisdom and compassion need to be, you know, conjoined. So great question to be, you know, and I'm not saying this is the answer, but I think there's some things to think about, and I can give you the link to this article afterwards if you'd like it. It's let's let this young lady back here. We got somebody got to share the airspace.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm remembering in this regard one of the things that Geshe Gelug said about this whole process is that the number one thing to work on is protecting your mind, and to protect your mind from disturbing thoughts. And if in fact empathy causes disturbing thoughts or causes you to be disturbed, then your job is to protect your mind from that. So you kind of short circuit the process and go and wish freedom from suffering rather than disturbing yourself with the suffering. Is that kind of where we're going?
Yeah, yeah. You know, Geshe Gelug, soon to be famous bumper sticker. It's on the back of my car. It says, think something good. I like that. Think something good. Jill, do we have t-shirts with that on there yet? Yeah. Oh, good. Okay, so including what? Oh, hoodies. Oh, my goodness. Well, hey, we're just going to go viral here pretty soon. Anyway, no, I think that's very, very astute. I think we do have a job to protect our mind. And, you know, for example, and this is so dangerous right now, rejoicing in people that we don't like, rejoicing in their hard times, you know, whether it be the Taliban or the president or one political party versus the other one or whatever's going on, rejoicing in other people's difficulties is, we get the karma for that, by the way. That we get the negative karma of that. So we don't need that either. That's not protecting our mind either. We need to rejoice in other people's good qualities. In fact, there, as one teacher said, we're all swimming in good qualities. We're swimming in good qualities. But what does our negative mind do? We find the problems and focus on them and then fixate on them and then concretize them and then operate as if they're that and that's how they always will be. Doesn't work. Only makes us suffer and screws up our relationships too. And, all right, Andre, you still got that question?
Yeah, it wasn't a question actually, but...
Wait,
I will.
The entire time you're talking.
Take a deep breath.
Yes, ma'am. All right. Yeah, it's just, it wasn't a question, but it was it's a book that was suggested to me, and I started reading it, and I'm using it to teach the guys in prison. It's a book called The Book of Forgiven by Archbishop Tutu, The Fourfold Path to Healing, and his daughter Mpho.
Right.
They wrote this book. I'm teaching it now to the guys at Nash Correctional,
right.
And it's a really, really good book on all these things you're talking about: compassion, forgiveness,
right.
Seeing the other person's suffering, recognizing why people harm others out of their own woundedness and so forth.
Right.
It's just a really wonderful, wonderful book. I think that anyone would like to read that. Is it in the bookstore?
Yeah.
It's an incredible book, and these guys are getting so much from it in the prison. Starting to learn how to forgive themselves first,
yeah.
And as we did in the meditation, and then working out towards being able to forgive others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, if we could just get this one, if we could just forgive this one, that'd be a great, if you could get that done between now and the time you died, you'd be in good shape. But, you know, taking it to others would be huge. And what is forgiveness, by the way? Anybody want to, what is forgiveness?
Don's favorite topic.
Don, no, well, one of them. What is forgiveness? Let's hear from somebody beside Andre. Let's go to the back wall back there, the people that are hiding out back there in the back. No, I'm just kidding. Anybody back there want to take that on? Okay.
I'm reminded of equanimity when I think about forgiveness.
About who now?
Equanimity. That they haven't done anything that I haven't done at some point, either in this life or some other. So... what's the use of having that attachment to anger? I know anger is one of the poisons.
Right.
And I lived in that for a very long time, seeing myself as a victim of somebody else's inappropriate, whatever you want to call it, behavior. And to free myself, to free my mind, and to free, I began to see, this person wasn't doing anything other than acting out of his own karmic load, so to speak. So, you know, and when I could see that, it wasn't about me. It was about that person. And when I could have compassion for that person's suffering that led them to do what they did to me,
right. Then
I was free. My mind was free.
Yeah, I think sometimes we have, so what's actually happening, I think, what I'm hearing anyway, what I experience too, is when we forgive someone for something that they've done, we're letting go of anger and resentment and being victimized or whatever. There's a process of letting go, and that's where compassion has such a huge part in enabling us to let go. Also, purification practice is a great way to forgive ourselves and others. Just imagine, for example, all of our negative karma, when we do Dorji Khadra, you know, all the negative karma of lying, of whatever, you know, you just try to remember all the things that you've done in this and past lifetimes, and you let it go. And then the result of purification practice is forgiveness, you know, and it's a great place to start. But it doesn't, I think we have forgiveness as at some level as well. If I forgive him, that means, or her, that means I'm condoning their behavior. Like, it's, you know, somehow, and that's not it. This is all about us. This is about my mind, my peace of mind going forward. Me forgiving you, if you've done something, or you forgiving me, benefits me. We're mostly interested in ourselves anyway. So self-forgiveness is really good for me. Forget, you know, if it helps you, fine. But Ken, this is a big area of, I think, misunderstanding about compassion. Does compassion mean that if there's social injustice, we just sit back and meditate about it, like this person's talking about, idiot compassion? Does that mean what we do? We sit around and we go, yeah, there's a lot of social injustice in the world. May they be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. Or does it, you know, or do we have to get angry to take action? Do we have to, like, really get mad? Is that really the only impetus for forceful action? I love the Zen stories where the Zen master, somebody asks the Zen master a question, and he gets up, picks the person up, and throws him out of the temple. Interesting. You know, I can remember Lama Yeshe getting up one time in the middle of a puja. For one of the first times I was at Kopan Monastery in Nepal, he got up in the middle of this puja, and he got up and he was chanting the whole time. He didn't even know, he barely opened his eyes. He got off his seat. Everybody else was, it was like 200 people there. Everybody's going, what's going to happen? He's getting up and he's kind of like, he looks like a zombie. I haven't really watched any of those zombie movies, but he kind of walks very slowly. His mala is in his hand. He walks over to this little monk, this little boy who's probably about 10 or 12 years old. And he takes his mala and he goes, whack! And the beads went everywhere. The mala burst, busted. And then he turned around, didn't open his eyes, chanting, sat back down. And, you know, now, was he just being mean? Or was he being compassionate? And what was his motivation? I don't know. But some of us sat around and thought, well, you know what? He must have thought it was more beneficial for this kid to be awake for this puja than to be sleeping. And so he wanted to give him that opportunity. And then I remember other times when Lama Yeshe, he was at Vajrapani one time, and all these guys were sitting around watching TV with Lama Yeshe, and he just got up and blew them out of the water. Told them they were basically a bunch of lazy, blah, 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 blah. And manifested his wrathful aspect. And they were going, whoa, this is our loving Lama who's now just kicking our butt. What is this all about? And then he walked out. And not one person there who respected and loved Lama Yeshe thought that anything had happened except for a profound teaching. A profound teaching in how to relate to the teacher and how to, you know, to take a look at yourself. Not blame him or get angry at him, but look at yourself. And I'm not sure how that ties into compassion, but I guess if you look at yourself, you realize you are a big mess and you need to do some work on yourself and have some empathy, compassion, sorry, for yourself. So I guess these handouts are just going to go home. That's fine. I don't know who's here next week. Who's here next week? Oh, okay. So we have none. Anyway, these are great little handouts, things that you can think about. By the way, this book I read many years ago, Jeffrey Hopkins, is called Cultivating Compassion. And it's, Jeffrey's been here to teach one time before we were at the Kadampa Center. He came to teach and led a weekend retreat and stuff. And, I don't see anybody here that was there, but except me. But anyway, he was a personal student and translator for the Dalai Lama for 10 years and very good. So let's do our dedication prayers now. What do we mean by dedication? It means that we planted some seeds, and the seeds that we planted are, I'm going to stick my neck out and say that we planted seeds of virtue. We planted seeds that that are going to go into our garden and ripen as beautiful flowers of nirvana, happiness, helping others, and supreme enlightenment eventually. So we want to give these karmic seeds a direction to protect them in a sense. So we want to dedicate the virtue. Hada, you want to take?
Okay. If you have the white binder, this is on the back of the first page of text. And in the gold prayer book, it is on page 246. And once again, we say this every week, and it's easy to just kind of blast through it, but let's try to think about our words for at least a stanza or two. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain a notion of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness, and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. And just a couple of really quick announcements. There is an orientation right after the teachings here in the Gompa for newcomers. If you're here for the very, well, you don't have to be here for the very first time, but if you want to just get an overview of how things work here at the center.